Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Futures in Biotech is provided by CashFly at CashFly.com.
This is Futures in Biotech, episode 72, a 4-billion-year-old social network. This episode of Futures in Biotech is brought to you by Kaleidograph, a thoughtfully designed graphing and data analysis application for research scientists as well as those in business and engineering fields. Try Kaleidograph for 45 days risk-free and receive a 20% discount if you purchase Kaleidograph within the next 60 days. Visit www.synergy.com/podcast.html.
I believe that biotech is the next frontier.
Probably the greatest intellectual revolution that's ever taken place in man's history. DNA is the code for life. We're actually beginning to understand how life works, which I think is something that's mind-blowing in and of itself.
There was going to be a genetic component to aging.
How long was there the extension?
About 30-40%. For humans, that would equate to something like 20 to 30 years.
How close are we to actually having a therapy?
Ballpark, 10 years.
It's potentially one of the things that will end up rocking the world the same way that people said, oh, the sun is the center of the universe, oh, this and that and everything. And now here's somebody who can come out and say, hey, look, here's how we compare it to our closest evolutionary relative.
Welcome to Futures in Biotech. I'm Mark Peltier. Today, we're really, really fortunate. We have Dr. Bonnie Bassler. Her name has come up time and time again as a guest for Futures in Biotech. And I finally found her connection on the Princeton site. She's a Howard Hughes Medical Institute investigator and professor of molecular biology and professor of chemistry at Princeton University. Welcome to the show. I really appreciate
Thanks.
You coming on.
It's fun to be here. Thanks.
Well, you're doing some very, very interesting work in the field of microbiology. And I'll let you go into it because you've probably got a really better, much better way to explain it. So I won't even try. So could you tell us a little bit about what excites you in the lab right now?
Okay, so my gang works on how bacteria talk to each other. So the question that we're curious about is how do collective behaviors evolve on this earth? That's one question. And the second question is how do bacteria accomplish so many miraculous things that they do and also so many awful things that they do? And so what we work on is how, in fact, they talk to each other with chemical words, if you will, and then tell each other when there's a lot of other cells around them, change their gene expression, which is really behavior, in unison so that they can carry out tasks that they would be unsuccessful at if they were acting as individuals.
Wow. how do you approach that? First of all, how did you get into that?
So it's sort of almost on a lark. I'm sort of horrified to tell you, but this got discovered by Woody Hastings, the original observation, probably now like almost 40, 50 years ago. He was so curious about bioluminescent bacteria that live in the ocean. So there's lots of people studying organisms make light. And Woody was a microbiologist. He's at Harvard. And he was interested in these amazing itty-bitty critters that make bioluminescence. And what he noticed really early on was that when the cells were alone, so when they were dilute, they didn't make light. But when they grew to a certain cell number, all of the bacteria turned on light in unison. And so he knew that there was something different between when they were alone and when they were in communities. And then the other experiment that he could do is he could take the cell-free soup, so the liquid that these cells had been grown in, if he took them from dense cells and squirted them on dilute cells, all the cells turned on light. So he realized there was something in the medium that they were letting go that he could add back that could trick them into thinking they were all in a group. So he knew there was a molecule there. Right. And so he actually figured out that in the early 70s. And so what was really, I think, so that was amazing. Period.
Well, the fact that they have behavior, that bacteria have behavior, they're not just passive growing critters. They actually think. Right. That's pretty wild.
I don't know if they think they count. Yeah, so it is okay. So that's the first amazing thing for back then, you know, was just this idea that that any bacterium had sort of the genetic wherewithal to tell the difference between times when it's alone and times when it's together. Because just like what you're saying, you know, people thought they were just boring. They grew, they divided, they grew, they divided, right? And so this showed that they had this social behavior. And then the other thing that was really amazing about his initial observation, you know, because you have to put this in context. This was 40 years ago. We didn't have all the slick techniques that we have now. It's that most things that bacteria do are invisible. So Woody's insight, biolumens, made the invisible world visible. It gave him and me, ultimately, something to track, right? You know, so now we get that cells do all kinds of things as groups, right? But how do you see that? And of course, we have all kinds of fancy techniques, you know, GFP and microarrays and reporter fusions. We have all kinds of ways to sort of see bacteria doing things, but they didn't have it back then. And so what was so great was that this bacterium came with this reporter, you know, bioluminescence, that was the readout of them talking together. And then he mined that. And then Mike Silverman, who was my postdoc boss, and I, you know, use that as well. You know, and now we have better ways to do it. But in fact, I think that this field would have been much further behind if he hadn't noticed in this sort of ridiculous, anomalous, glow-in-the-dark bacterium that lives in the ocean, that light. You know, it would have taken a lot longer to see that bacteria were doing this.
I bet when he first saw the experiment, right, maybe they thought he was a little crazy. I tell you, it's flashing.
Yeah.
And I take it off.
Right. So in his defense, they're beautiful. So you're not allowed to be a human being and not think bioluminescence is beautiful. So that'll get everybody to look at it. But they did think he was crazy, again, and you've already alluded to this, because, well, crazy is a strong word. They thought this was there was this snobbery, and I mean, among us, among bacteriologists too, that we couldn't believe it was then, and this is up until really like 20 years or so years ago, that it was thought it's really high sophisticated kinds of behaviors, social behaviors, group behaviors, really fancy signaling, you know, circuits, that was the purview of eukaryotes, and bacteria did really simple stuff. You know, and so the fact, I think what worked against Woody and then Mike Silverman after him, who I should just be clear, Mike Silverman's the one that figured out the genes, you know, what was the actual circuitry to make and respond to the molecule and turn on bioluminescence. So that's what Mike Silverman did in the 80s. And so even though those guys' findings were out there long before I ever or anybody else got on the scene, I think because they were found in these bacteria that never heard anything, that, you know, lived this weird life in the ocean, that had this beautiful but kind of weird property of bioluminescence, they thought that even though it was, you know, everybody believed their result, but they thought that is only about that one special funny bacteria. This isn't generic about all bacteria, which is what we understand now. And so they were kind of fringy scientists in, you know, for working on this critter.
Well, it seems like a really fun, testable system, in that even the original one, the original setup looking for the bioluminescent change, that here you have an observable behavior that's fairly simple. You should be able to dissect both the genetic, the biochemistry, you know,
That's exactly what they did. It was beautiful. I mean, this bacterium gave them such a gift by making this light, because, you know, all you had to do was, I'm a geneticist, Mike Silverman's a geneticist. You make mutants, you plate them out on the Petri plates, you turn the lights off, and you look for guys that are glowing when they shouldn't be glowing or not glowing when they should be glowing. I mean, a monkey could do it. It's so easy. And, you know, and this is what now, you know, we still do this. Actually, this is basically how I've made my living. But, you know, you can do that, and people do it with GFP, or they do it with transcriptomes. It's all the same thing, except that this was built in long before we understood how to build these things into our systems.
You're working on, half the lab is working on the bacterial process, the bacterial, or the genetic and biochemical elements that lead to the ability of these bacteria to sense each other and then trigger bioluminescent a cascade or light. First of all, one, are there, I mean, they picked this as something that happened when they originally discovered it. Did they see, well, this is really interesting because it's a good system because it represents the behavior of all bacteria in terms of nutrient uptake or...
Yeah. So, of course, you know, I wish we were so smart as that. So to be honest about this, so I should give you some more of a timeline. So I told you what Woody did. I told you what Mike did. And most of their work was in an organism named Vibrio fischeri, which lives as a symbiont with a number of marine animals. And so in those cases, Vibrio fischeri provides light. And the host uses the light to find a mate, to scare away predators, to attract prey. And in response, the host feeds Vibrio fischeri, and it gets to make many more of itself. And that's the evolutionary selection from each point. And when I went to, so the things that I told you, they knew. They knew the molecule. They knew the genetic circuitry in this bioluminescent bacterium Vibrio fischeri. That was a symbiont. And then I heard that story. So I heard Mike Silverman give a talk sort of shortly after he figured out this genetic circuitry that I told you about, you know, this, that they make a molecule, they have a receptor. When the molecule gets to a high amount, which tells the bacteria how many cells there are, they turn on light. And so I basically heard that talk and thought, holy moly, you know, the bacteria are talking to each other. And I thought, I'm definitely smart enough to turn the lights off in the room and do something like that. And so I sort of ran up to him and said, you know, you have to let me be your postdoc or I'll kill myself. And he took me on. And what we decided to do when I was a postdoc with him, to figure out, is this generally of this one bacterium or is this more general? And can there be more to it? And so what he and I decided to do together was to transition to another bacterium that Woody had found. It's a cousin of Vibrio fischeri. This bacterium's named Vibrio harveyi. It's bioluminescent. We knew it made light at high cell number. You know, we knew there was a molecule there, but it lives free living. And so we thought, because it doesn't get this pristine, fantastic life, you know, within this one-to-one life with a host, maybe because Vibrio harveyi has to fend for itself in the ocean, it'll have a more sophisticated circuit. So I went to Mike's lab to start working on that. And I did the experiments that you and I have been talking about. I made mutants and looked for guys that were goofy in light production. And what we found is that, in fact, there were two signals. So there was one, there were two molecules, each had their own receptor, and then that information came in to tell Vibrio harveyi to turn on or off light. And I should also say, and I do remember your question, I'm going to get to it. So now we know there's two molecules, so it's getting really crazy, right? It was sort of weird enough that the bacteria could talk, and now, you know, the idea that there's multiple molecules involved, right, seems quite intricate. And then what we also found is that this isn't just about light, right? Like, it was the thing we could assay. But in fact, in Vibrio harveyi and in Vibrio fischeri, hundreds of genes turn on and off in response to these molecules. So when a bacterium makes the switch from going alone to acting as part of a collective, it's an enormous developmental, you know, genetic program where genes get turned on in the right order to the right amount, just like when an embryo develops. I mean, this is bacterial development. So that's what we figured out. And then later, when I came here, what we figured out was that the question we had was, why do you need two molecules? And so what we showed is that the first molecule, the one that Woody and Mike had worked on, is the harveyi uses that to count its siblings and decide what to do. And then the other molecule we found out was generic. It's made by essentially all bacteria. And so we think that's the interspecies communication signal. And so that so all bacteria have that. And so what we think, all bacteria, all is a big word. What we think in general, the rule is that any bacterium is going to have a molecule very specific that says me and my sister. And then they use the second molecule, which everybody is using exactly the same molecule, to say you. And what they do, the computation that I think bacteria do, they say, is there anybody else around? So first they scan the environment for molecules. And then that sets the initial program of, I'm going to go solo, I'm going to act as part of a group. Then the second computation they do, it's harder, is they say, is it me or is it you? And so then they measure how much of my own signal is there, how much of the generic signal is there, and then they tailor this program of these 100 genes based on who's winning and who's losing in any given environment. Right? And so then the answer to your question, yeah, it's fun, right? It's what we do, right? And so in answer to your question, which I think was, is this just a crazy back? You know, back then... Now, so what I'm trying to tell you, sorry, I'm trying to talk slowly too. It's okay. How am I doing? Anyway, what I'm trying to tell you, my thing is too slow. Should I turn my video off? No, you don't want me to do that.
No.
I'll keep my video on. Okay. So what I'm trying to tell you is that bacteria, just like eukaryotic cells, can also other. They have chemical ways that say me and chemical ways that say them. And so now the question is, did you think it was all these bacteria, back then? And so we never, I remember when I was working with Mike, we thought we were working on how does information get into cells? We are working on that. How do you get synchronous behaviors? And we thought back then, when we didn't know there were any other bacteria that did this, we thought this bioluminescence is so cool. It's such a great readout to study information processing, right? But now I have to say, when I think back, I think, how could we have been so stupid, A, not to think all bacteria have to know when they're alone or when they're together, and also not to think there were going to be multiple molecules involved. Now when I tell you this story, it seems so obvious, right? Where do you think multicellularity came from? I mean, bacteria have been here for 4 billion years. They invented collective behaviors. They invented chemical signaling. They learned how to, make these little circuits that integrate information. And eukaryotes got smarter and added bells and whistles and more molecules and stuff. But the principles are really embedded in these systems. And, I always think would have gone so much faster if we could have been like you said, which is to be able to think it had to be like this, but we just didn't. Thought it was a great system.
I think is really neat here. Now we're at like a 3-second lag. One thing that I think is really neat is the social behavior of a single cell organism came before, probably evolutionary, came before the behavior of the intercellular exchanges required for a multicellular organism. Absolutely. So we already knew how to work together.
Yeah. So this, I think, and am I right? Am I wrong? I don't know. But I think, these are really ancient processes. And so in stuff we haven't talked about, like my gang figures out what these molecules are. And these molecules are made from some of the oldest components in cells, right? So they're made from sort of leftovers of central metabolism. So we know these systems are really, really old, mm-hmm. right? And so, when you think about it now, maybe it shouldn't have been such a surprise. Like, I'm always surprised that this got missed for 350 years, like when you think about the life of a bacterium, if a bacterium's trying to accomplish something, be a pathogen, be a symbiont, make some enzyme that you have to let go and get the product back. Bacteria live, they're tiny and they live in this enormous world. They never have a prayer if I give something away of getting my own back. They have to have collective behaviors, to get any bang for their buck. And so, in retrospect, of course, it's so obvious. But we weren't that smart. It took 20 years for us. And I'm sure 20 years from now, I think, my God, she was like a cave woman when, thinking about it. So it's fun. I need a job.
I'm trying to think, what is the advantage to be able to help your community out when really you basically reproduce vegetatively, right? Or right. No, bacteria don't. Bacteria have sexual reproduction as well.
Sometimes they have sex. So we're controlled by I should tell you this whole process, this process where bacteria release these molecules, they recognize the amount of molecule, which as a proxy for cell number, and then they all respond. We call that quorum sensing, right? They sense, they vote with these chemical votes, they count the vote, and then everybody does something. So now we have a fancy name for it. It's called quorum sensing. And so a colleague of mine at Cornell, Steve Winans, made that funny name up, which we love. So, so your question is why do it? And this is not altruism, absolutely not. But remember, so the kinds of behaviors that are controlled by quorum sensing, at least the way we understand it right now, are things where bacteria has to make something, you know, a protein, an enzyme, something, and they have to release it from themselves, right? And the way a bacteria lives, if one does that, this molecule, say you have your fancy toxin or your protein that's going to go scavenge iron from the environment, if you let it go, you're not going to get yours back because you're in this big world. And so the collective is the thing that evolution has made flourish. And so if they didn't have to do it, they wouldn't, right? And then remember, unlike the way we think about individuality, right? These are clones, you know? So when I divide and make more of myself, you are me and I am you, right? We are all the same. And if one of us survives, the entire species has survived. I mean, so if I can sort of anthropomorphize, bacteria don't think about individuality quite the same way as we do, right? Because they're clones of each other. They're identical.
Right. They're the Borg.
Yeah, exactly, right? And so I do think they think about other, I'm talking other differently. You know, they really do try to kill off competitors. They do all kinds of nasty things when they have other species around. But I think, number one, they have to work together to accomplish, to reap the benefits of many of the tasks they carry out. And so evolution has allowed this trait of the social behavior to evolve because it helps the species survive.
Let's take a moment. Let's take a moment. We'll thank our sponsor, and then we'll get back to the concept of quorum sensing. Maybe discuss a little bit of the chemistry behind it, sure. the receptors. I'd love to know more about the receptors, the evolutionary conservation of the receptors. Maybe they're in mammalian systems. Maybe we've evolved certain forms of cancer that are triggered by the same receptors, because, you know, cancer cells do funky things too, and they tend to spread. And perhaps we can let's start with that. Then we'll see where the conversation goes, because this is an open-ended. Science is open-ended, so there's... Okay, so let me take a second to thank our sponsors. Our sponsor today is for this episode of Futures of Biotech is Kaleidograph. Kaleidograph is a thoughtfully designed graphing and data analysis application for research scientists, business professionals, and engineers. It produces publication-quality graphs and easily converts the most complex data into a functional display. Statistics, linear, nonlinear curve fitting, and the ability to produce precise graphic visualization of data all make Kaleidograph powerful and flexible. Since 1988, Kaleidograph has been an easy-to-learn graphic analysis program with a surprisingly affordable price. Try Kaleidograph for 45 days risk-free and purchase Kaleidograph then within the next 60 days, and you'll receive a 20% discount if you purchase. Visit www.synergy.com/podcast.htm for more details. I was using it most of the evening last night. I do cell-based assays, but you can use it for enzymology. What I really like about Kaleidograph is your ability to use the correct curve. You don't have to use, I mean, they give you hundreds of curves that you can do for your curve fitting. But you can do bar charts and all kinds of other stuff. But I particularly like it for curve fitting, because out there, there's not a lot of great solutions for curve fitting. And this was one that is so simple to use. You don't have to, there's a very short learning curve for it. And then, well, ironically, so you can model the right equation. And sometimes I work on water permeabilities through for the aquaporin, so I want to study how water gets into the cell, but if it's going in through just the lipid and then slash it's going through the protein, you've got two elements there. So you use a double exponential curve, when and that it's just the easiest thing to plop into the software and run your curve fitting, and you get the data right away. Then you can port it any which way you want, get it into your talk, get it into a publication. It's really, I mean, it's part of your tool set as a scientist to have Clytograph around. It's available for Mac and PC. So again, visit www.synergy.com/podcast.htm for more details. We thank them for the support of Futures in Biotech. All right. By the way, do you use Clytograph?
Maybe.
You know what? I bet it's in your lab. How many folks?
All right. I know. Like, this is like a side of me I don't want you to know. I can use spell check. Yeah, I'm sure it is in my lab, but they would.
I'm sure
I'm a voyeur of data at this point.
And it's in your department for sure. Everybody, I mean, it's sure omnipresent in the biological world. So we're talking quorum sensing with Dr. Bonnie Bassler from Princeton University, and she's a Howard Hughes Medical Institute investigator. And so let's talk a little bit about how did I have it? My handwriting is so horrible. Number of molecules. So we talked a little bit about the behavior. Did we really cover what other bacteria use this system?
Yeah, So what I was saying is that this started with bioluminescent bacteria, but now lots of my colleagues in the field have shown that the quorum sensing controls pathogenicity. So the idea is when a bacterium gets into a host, you know, a plant, an animal, a human, right? If one bacterium released its virulence factors, number one, they would disappear, and number two, it wouldn't have an impact on an enormous host. And so now what we have are hundreds of examples of clinically relevant bacteria that require quorum sensing to initiate virulence. And so the idea is that the bacteria get into the host, they wait, they count themselves with these small molecules, they recognize when they have the right number that if all the bacteria release their toxins in unison, they're going to be able to establish a toehold in an otherwise, you know, impossible, a host that's much bigger than they are. And so we know now that this plays a huge role in pathogenesis, in name whatever your pet pathogen is, it probably has quorum sensing, or it's at least in many cases been shown that if you knock out these components, either make the bacteria so they can't talk or they can't hear, they're avirulent.
When you found
this
out,
makes sense, right?
It makes sense, but that must have been a huge have huge implications of your work. It sort of broadened it into a medical relevance.
Call that the mainstream, right? Yes. So for us,
well, the potential to save millions and millions of lives.
Hopefully, so that I think is a real fantasy and a goal of this whole field. So the first thing is that it really legitimized the science from Mike Silverman and Woody Hastings, not, you know, cranks, me too, right? Because, you know, it wasn't just about bioluminescence. This was about bacteria, you know, that affect our lives, right? And so that was great because it made the field explode, right? So that we just started learning a lot more faster because a lot more people got into it. And so that's just great for understanding the phenomenon and for having a field of colleagues, you know, many colleagues to talk to. So that's great. And then second is what you said, and this we can get into the chemicals if you want to, is that we get it now. We get that bacteria have these social behaviors. We get that they talk with molecules. And so now many of us in the field are very curious about the idea is, could we make bacteria that can't talk or they can't hear, and those could be new kinds of therapeutics? And so, you know, there's this globally important problem of antibiotic resistance. We have to have new kinds of antibiotics, you know, whether they're derivatives of the antibiotics we have or brand new classes of antibiotics, we need new molecules. The idea that's sort of been bubbling up since this quorum sensing business began, you know, in a real, where lots of us have been working on this, is this idea of if you could interfere with this communication, would that be enough to be to make an antibiotic? And I should just say that, you know, every antibiotic you've ever taken either kills bacteria or stops their growth. That's how they work. So not clear that you can have a therapeutic that doesn't do that, you know, one that just makes them think they're alone, gives your immune system time to get rid of the invaders. But that's what we're trying to find out. Lots of people in my field. It's just fun. For me, it's especially fun. And I think for those of us that have been in it for a long time, it's really fun to watch this field move from this harmless but beautiful bacteria into the extremely applied clinical, you know, world, right? We didn't actually think that back then.
It's really a case of know your enemy.
right. There's no question. You didn't ask me a question.
Oh, so no, perhaps you could comment on that. So I'm still trying to digest this because it's a whole lot of, you know, interesting biology here. On the one hand, you know, I'd love to ask you about why do these bioluminescent creatures want to make their hosts luminescent? How do they do it? How close do they have to be? What organs? What, you know, I think isn't 50% of the creatures or 35% of all creatures that live below a certain sea level luminescent? Do they all use this? Just, we could start from there or go all the way down to the other end and say, well, how do you develop an antibiotic to, radar jamming the communication lines between bacteria? I guess you use your bioluminescent reporter and screen for drugs that
shut down light. Yep.
That compete with that signaling molecule. Do you have receptors from all these pathogenic bacteria? Have they all been characterized?
So to various levels. And so again, as I mentioned earlier, what's so funny is we know the best characterized systems are these bioluminescent guys, just because we've been at it longer, right? And other systems are coming along. And so there are so different pathogens depending on when quorum sensing got discovered in, you know, pathogen A, B, or C, you know, they're coming along. And so but there are themes, right? So we know now a lot about, just from studying these first systems, you know, there's sort of unifying principles like gram-negative bacteria, that's like Vibrios, E. coli, Salmonella, they all use a particular kind of molecule. Gram-positive bacteria, Staph, Strep, Enterococcus, they use a different kind of molecule to say me. And so see what I mean? There's rules. And so even though we don't know every detail in every system, we can work it out in a couple of systems. Find, for example, if we're thinking about antibiotics, we can find antagonists in, say, one bacterium and then test them against other bacteria, right? To see, are they broad spectrum or are they specific? And so it is true that we don't know as much in every single pathogen that we'd like to know, but there's common themes. You know, evolution invents something that works and then you modify it a little bit and you have a different species, but in fact, the receptors look alike, the molecules look similar. You know, we can do a lot even by only having picked apart in incredible detail a few systems.
Now, you said the Vibrio, the two species that you first worked on, one was a symbiont and the other one lived as a unicellular
free-living
bacteria. How do you say it?
Free-living.
So,
yeah, free living, just in the water.
Do both of them do quorum sensing? I suppose they do, because the first one was the one, and you discovered the next one. So
you both have.
The fact that quorum sensing was used for that behavior of turning on the light or the bioluminescence in as a symbiont, it makes it. This is how I'm starting to understand it. In a pathogenic bacteria, who wants to do the same thing, except rather maybe not necessarily kill you, just propagate get enough through you until it gets through the mucous membranes and off to the next creature.
Absolutely. Right. So you can think of pathogenesis as sort of symbiosis gone bad. And so, you know, I think that, you know, if I can say the goals, you know, are similar, right? A pathogenic bacteria, and I should say that there's beautiful work on the bioluminescent bacteria and their hosts by Margaret McFall and Ned Ruby, who have thought about how quorum sensing helps in the symbiosis, you know, both from the bacterial point of view. So this is very well studied. And so the sort of goals for a pathogen or a symbiont, they're similar. You know, you want to get into a particular site in a host and stay there, right? And so what you should know is that you're filled with commensal bacteria. I mean, you have 10 times more bacterial cells in you and on you than human cells, right? And those guys are chatting like crazy, right? And so this isn't just about bioluminescent symbionts and just about pathogens. This is about bacteria living in associations with hosts. And so your good bacteria also have quorum sensing, and they use it much like this symbiotic relationship we were talking about, but to keep you healthy, right? And so, you know, so what I should say, like, if there's a principle, it's that bacteria need to count. They need to understand when they're alone, when they're in groups. They do this with these molecules, but then what happens at the bottom of the cascade? What genes get turned on? Has to do with who that bacterium is, if it's a pathogen, if it's a symbiont, if it's a commensal bacteria, right? The idea is the same. It's just the output that's different at the bottom of the cascade.
Are there multiple forms of the receptor?
Yeah. So the receptors are they sort of come in two forms, and they're all extremely specific for a molecule. It's like they don't get mixed up, right, when they talk, right? Because each receptor, they fit like locks and keys, the molecules into the receptors. And so each receptor is responsible, as far as we know, for detecting a single molecule, right? So if I talk with two or three molecules, I have two or three cognate receptors to detect those molecules. And then the information gets integrated inside the cell in a beautiful, you would like this, in a beautiful engineering system where there's feedback loops and noise reduction, there's filters, there's checking to make sure it wasn't just some random molecule that floats by. I mean, it's an incredibly sophisticated little circuit board that tells these bacteria you either should be going it alone or you should turn on these 100 genes, which are expensive, you know, and be a group.
It's a form of intelligence. I suppose it's either artificial intelligence because it's so simple, or is it that's the true intelligence because it's so evolved into such a simple form? Because well, it's a logic, right?
It's definitely logic. And, you know, these same exact strategies for filtering out noise, for amplifying signals, this happens in your body too, right? These are how your hormones get detected. This is how your neurons work, right? It's not, absolutely, we eukaryotes use more sophisticated molecules. We probably have many more molecules that we can detect, many more feedback loops and, you know, sort of a more fancy architecture. But the principles, the way the signals get detected, the way the information flows, the way, you know, fidelity is maintained, it's actually all there in these bacterial systems. And so I think you're intelligent because you have these systems. I don't think it's much different. You know, I think, you know, intelligence is biochemistry and wiring and, you know, things going on that are, you know, genetic and biochemical, right?
Has anyone ever looked at this in a community setting and seen specific communication links between various genus of bacteria?
Absolutely. So first, they can talk across species with this sort of generic molecule. But I think what you're getting at, absolutely, they can eavesdrop, they free ride, they actually make antagonists, you know, they eat each other's molecules, they do all kinds of crazy stuff to try, right? Because remember, in a lot of niches out there, you know, bacteria are competing against bacteria. And so they have tuned in to each other's signals in a way that allows them, you know, just the same way we want to make you know, inhibitors, they invented that 4 billion years ago. And so, in fact, those strategies exist in the bacterial world.
So how, if they have strategies to do every possible form of competition, either tease the other bacteria into thinking, oh yeah, you got quorum, but you don't. Mm-hmm. And then they die. Or yes, you do have quorum, but I'm going to send you a signal that says you don't. And you know, that I'm sure this happens. Is this the approach that to develop an antibiotic with, which do you think are going to be the most effective strategies to kill the pathogenesis?
So of course, you know, I don't know. So we're trying a whole battery. We and lots of people in the field are trying many things. But what you said, I do think, you know, what's so interesting is that, you know, we meaning scientists have, you know, identified a few of these molecules, you know, by tinkering chemically with the molecules, we've made a few inhibitors. But in fact, lots of my colleagues now have said there's no freaking way a scientist is going to make a better inhibitor than what bacteria invented 4 billion years ago. The ones that are out there working in these natural niches, those have been tried and tested over evolution. And so lots of people now are just going out and digging up dirt, you know, or seawater or gudge, and asking, what are those molecules? And that's exactly how our original antibiotics came, right? Those came from fungi, right? And so I think that
there's a new company, by the way, that just formed to do exactly that, Metagenomics in New Haven.
Absolutely, right. So I think that like sort of panning for, you know, this treasure trove of molecules that are out there is a great idea. And so what I don't know, so we're trying, you know, things. One is to make antagonists, so block the receptor, block production of the signal. And then also one other, I think, fun strategy now that people are getting into, but it's the newest, is as you and I were talking about, we now get that these commensal bacteria that we have, you know, that live with us all the time, they have quorum sensing. And we also know that those commensals play an active role hand in hand with your immune system in keeping invading microbes out. And so maybe the best strategy, instead of trying to thwart the invaders, is to make pro-quorum sensing molecules and just beef up the conversation of the commensal bacteria so they're better at keeping you healthy. And so that's the other strategy that's now being explored as well.
It sounds like there's a whole new field of medicine that's going to develop. Because, or as you said, with 10 times more bacteria on us than actual human cells, we're more bacteria than we are human. And with the metagenome being done, the number of receptors that are being cloned, and with the new high throughput systems to really extract the novel natural compounds that are coming out of these bacteria, this is basically a new medicine. It's a new acupuncture, but one that's scientifically driven. Not that the acupuncture wasn't scientific. I won't go there, but this is, and this is it's just an incredible story. And I think if we could have you back on in a few months to get a follow up, and of course, if you ever have any great publications that you want to, you know, report here first, we'd be more than welcome to have you back.
I'll
on.
Talk to my lab about that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We could bring on your
really
postdocs
fun.
As well. We'd be glad to bring them on as well. We interview Susan Lindquist probably once every 2 years, and she reports her major publications, and she brings on the scientists that are doing the experiments with her. So maybe we could do that.
Absolutely.
Do you have any last thoughts?
A bunch of hams. We'd love to. Yeah, I think that this field. Sort of typical of how, you know, science happens. You know, somebody's curious about some ridiculous thing, you know, beautiful glow-in-the-dark bacteria. And like, you know, you just let a bunch of young people, like these people in my lab and all these other quorum sensing labs, loose on this. And, you know, it's sort of like you can never tell where it's going to go. But I think this is sort of like just totally stereotypical of the way science happens, you know. And so it's been a blast to work on, and it's really fun to go to work on the abstract part, just how does information get processed, and then actually, you know, in the end we are do-gooders. We do want to make life better. So it's really fun to actually be in it long enough for me to go from this very initial, you know, how is information sorted out, to like actually having the dream to be making something that's useful for human beings. And so I think this field, you know, this field has hundreds of labs in it, and we are on top of the world.
So I'm wondering, since you're trying to, you're basically working out the language of the microbial world, we could call this show Bacteria Whisperer.
Yeah, or absolutely.
Maybe, or perhaps Bacteria Social Creatures.
Bacterial social interactions. Yeah.
Zuckerberg didn't invent it. Bacteria did. This is an amazing story, and I really look forward to following your work more and seeing how this story plays out. I'm just looking at the potential as an entrepreneur. I think, wow, I'd love to to discuss this off air with you and see what's going on at your. I mean, Princeton must be really, it's a great place to do this, to translate this work to clinic as well. So there must be some really great stuff going on. But perhaps that'd be the subject of another show.
Great.
I'd like to thank our guest today, Dr. Bonnie Bassler. She's a Howard Hughes Medical Institute investigator and professor of molecular biology and professor of chemistry at Princeton University. I'd also like to thank Bert McQuinn for handling the audio and video boards today. And the recordings. We had a little bit of a difficulty, but I appreciate your patience. The story was fantastic. So sometimes we have to deal with the internet, interwebs, and Princeton and MIT are sometimes a little difficult. I'd also like to thank the team that make this possible: Leo Laporte, Lisa Kenzel, Frederic Louis, Ken Shepherdson, Tony Wang, Mike Taylor, John Salinia, John Stewart, Jeff Stewart, Jason Howell, and also Aileen Rivera. Lastly, I'd like to thank Phil Pelsey and Will Hall for the opening and closing themes. If you have any comments or suggestions, please feel free to call or send me an email at mark@twit.tv. Or you can send me a message on Twitter, and it's at MarkPelletier. For Futures in Biotech, I'm Mark Pelsey.